All right, we're back. Continuing our discussion on biological weapons with UC Davis microbiologist Dr. Mark Wheelis. Now, as far as I can see, the idea that smallpox might be used as a weapon is quite far-fetched at this point.
I would agree with that. I think it's pretty far-fetched. The problem with dealing with the threat of biological weapons, either in terrorist hands or in state hands, in the case of something like Iraq, is that we really have no basis on which to assess the threat accurately. As a result, we tend to plan on the basis of worst-case scenario. Now, if there was a deliberate terrorist release of smallpox, it could be a global public health disaster that would dwarf anything that has ever happened to the human race. Smallpox was eradicated by the World Health Organization in the late 1970s, an achievement that I think was arguably the most substantial achievement in public health ever. I think it deserved a Nobel Prize in medicine, if not in peace.
The only disease mankind has eliminated to date.
The only one eliminated to date, although measles and polio are perhaps to be eradicated sometime in the next few years. But smallpox was undoubtedly the worst, in terms of its cost in death and suffering, was undoubtedly the worst disease humans have ever had to cope with. And it's the mortality it caused was truly staggering, and its eradication was a tremendous achievement. To deliberately reintroduce it would be a crime against humanity of really incalculable magnitude. The fact that since it was eradicated in the late 1970s, nobody, at least as far as we know, with the possible exception of military troops of some nations, nobody's been being vaccinated against it. And so the entire world population to date is essentially all susceptible to smallpox. Smallpox is a highly contagious, highly infectious disease, kills about 30% of the people it infects. Its spread can only be stopped by vaccination. And at the present time, although the United States has stockpiles of vaccine that would allow us to contain an outbreak in this country with a small to a large number of deaths depending on the nature of the attack, there's no way we could prevent it from spreading worldwide. And once it gets out into the world, there's essentially no stopping it. It would kill an untold tens or hundreds of millions of people. And I think over 5 to 10 years, it could kill as many as a billion people.
Some have pointed out, including myself on this program, that this makes smallpox an unlikely weapon to be used by any state, such as Iraq or North Korea. We perhaps are a lot less reassured about use by a suicide cult like Aum Shinrikyo.
I would agree with that. I think even someone as deranged as Saddam Hussein is unlikely to, even if he has the virus, which we know of two legitimate stocks of virus in the world, one in the Soviet Union and at Vector in Koltsovo, and one in the United States in Atlanta at the CDC. There is speculation that some other nations, including Iraq and North Korea, have retained secret stocks of the virus, but there's no evidence whatsoever, as far as I know, that they have. So it's simply speculation. Even if they had the virus, would certainly hope that they would recognize two things. First of all, they will mainly be killing people in the third world if it's released. The United States, the UK, Western Europe will suffer, but they'll be able to contain and eradicate the disease within their territory relatively rapidly. The people who will suffer most are the people in Africa, the people in South Asia, the people in the developing countries whom terrorists or Saddam would most claim to be representing. That's the first reason. And the second reason is that whoever did this would go down in history as one of the most monstrous criminals ever, probably eclipsing Hitler as a cause of monstrous human suffering. And that is not a legacy that I would think very many people would elect. Despite the fact that I think it is an exceedingly unlikely threat, I think the United States has been wise in boosting its vaccine stockpiles just in case.
Sure.
That there is a possibility that it might be deliberately released, and there's also a possibility that there might be a laboratory accident somewhere at some time, or some, Eskimo casualty from, the early in the 20th century defrosting out of the permafrost because of global warming or so. Who knows what? So accidental release is also a possibility, and we have to be prepared for that.
And the fact that, it's known that we have stockpiled enough vaccine to inoculate everyone in the United States makes it that much less likely anyone will employ it as a weapon.
Yes. We talked briefly earlier of the BWC, the Biological Weapons Convention, that outlaws biological weapons. Biological weapons being defined either as infectious microorganisms or as their toxins, such as the botulinum toxin that Aum Shinrikyo had been working with. This was the first arms control treaty to ever completely outlaw a category of weapon of mass destruction. It's a landmark in arms control and disarmament. But it had one principal flaw, and that was that it did not have embedded in it any mechanism for countries to verify that other countries were following its dictates. And as we just saw, the Soviet Union, one of the major proponents of this treaty, in fact violated it in a massive way over the course of nearly two decades. We also know Iraq violated the treaty, South Africa violated the treaty, there are probably several others that are suspected as well. When both the Iraqi program and the Soviet program became known in the world, there developed a considerable amount of pressure to try to develop a second treaty which would add a bunch of inspection provisions to the Biological Weapons Convention. And negotiations started on such a treaty in earnest in the early 90s, and about 7 years' worth of active negotiation then there was a sort of build-up phase, but basically then by the middle of last year, there was a draft treaty available, and it was thought by most people that another couple of months would see the finishing of the treaty and its opening for signature. And at that point, the United States pulled out of the treaty.
Can you go through the reasons that were given for America's withdrawal?
Three principal reasons for backing out. One was that the inspections that would be mandated by this treaty would threaten U.S. Pharmaceutical and biotech industries by putting their commercial secrets at risk. Secondly, that the treaty wouldn't really work anyway. It wouldn't catch cheaters. It was too weak. And thirdly, that it would put U.S. biodefense efforts at risk. The first two reasons are generally thought by a number of analysts to be smoke screens. I've worked with PhRMA, the industry organization that represents the pharmaceutical industry, and although there's no question but what PhRMA opposed a number of elements in that treaty, I know from many hours of discussion with them that if they had to, they could live with it. They don't like it, but they could live with it. I also know that and so did the U.S. negotiators, that the point of this treaty was not to turn up smoking guns and catch cheaters. The point of the treaty was to increase the transparency worldwide of biodefense programs and of pharmaceutical industry so that we got a much better notion of what countries were doing inside their borders. And it would, in almost all of the cases in which we have suspicions that there might be something nasty going on, better understanding and frequent visits to the facilities involved would allay those suspicions. It is certainly true that the treaty would not have prevented a really determined proliferator from doing that, but it would have allowed us to sharpen our intelligence focus greatly upon the very small number of countries that might elect to do that. The United States understood this. I talked to the second in command, for instance, of the U.S. delegation in Geneva about 5 years before the U.S. backed out of this program. I was critical of U.S. efforts at that time to water down the treaty a little bit. And the second in command of the U.S. Delegation said, well, you know, we really don't have a lot of hopes for this treaty being able to really verify compliance. We just want to have a mechanism to get people on the ground in these countries of concern. So the U.S. recognized very clearly that this was not, the point of the treaty was not to be ironclad.
It wouldn't be 100%.
It wouldn't be 100%, but it would let us get international teams into facilities that were of concern to people and give us more familiarity with what they were doing. Protecting its own biodefense is a real reason that we backed out of the treaty. And that, in fact, was admitted by Don Maley, the chief U.S. negotiator in congressional testimony. He said that this was really the principal reason. And there's two components to that. One is that much of our biodefense is done in laboratories like the U.S. DOE laboratories at Lawrence Livermore and at Los Alamos, in which lots of other highly sensitive stuff is going on as well. And so the U.S. has argued that the fact this is all intermixed together makes it really threatening to have international inspectors poking around in those facilities. Of course, I don't see why we couldn't separate them.
Well, that strikes me as a lame excuse.
seems pretty lame to me. The critics of the U.S. program have come to speculate that possibly the U.S. is hiding something. And the reason that, and I would identify myself with that that group of arms control experts, the reason we think that it's likely that the U.S. doesn't want these visits, mainly because it wants to be able to do stuff which is flirting with illegality under the treaty. And the evidence for that is simply that there has been some investigative journalism which has showed we have, in the past, done things under the name of BIOF defense.
We know, I take it, of at least three clandestine programs.
Probably, and then a fourth and when the anthrax letter attacks began to be investigated, it became clear that the U.S. was continually producing weaponized anthrax, presumably for biodefense testing. I don't question the assertion that this was being done for defensive motives. I do question whether it was technically legal under the treaty. There were several other things that were being done. The CIA, for instance, had a program to try to reconstruct a Soviet-era biological munition, cluster munition. That's flat-out illegal under the treaty.
I don't see why we can't just go to Vladimir Putin, who's now our pal, and just ask him, what was that all about?
That's a good question. And in fact, Russia is considerably less open and forthcoming about biodefense issues than in other areas. Despite the Yeltsin back in the early 90s ordered the entire offensive biological weapons program canceled. But Russia will still not let U.S. Visitors into several of the principal former military centers for these programs. So there's still a considerable amount of suspicion that there may be some residual activity in these programs. There's some concern that the civilian government has less than complete control over the military in this area. So apparently the CIA tried to get one of these Soviet munitions. They tried to buy it on the black market and couldn't, which I found encouraging, frankly.
Yeah.
I would have been worried if they'd been able to. But since they couldn't find one, they decided to try to make it from fragments that they'd recovered in Afghanistan, reverse engineer it. And that's flat out illegal. You just can't make a munition to disseminate biological agents, even for the purposes of defensive study.
Right. They're also trying to recreate Soviet anthrax that's vaccine resistant, which I guess they're not being forthcoming about, but we suspect they did.
Yeah, well, there certainly was a plan to do that. Whether it was actually implemented or not is not clear, and it would certainly be nice to know. But the fact that the U.S. is willing to sort of skirt or certainly press the limits of legality, and in some cases clearly to overstep them, in the interests of its own biodefense program, suggests to a lot of us that the U.S. has basically abandoned efforts to control the spread of these weapons and is focusing now on technical measures to respond to them, and that the treaty, the Biological Weapons Convention, has become more of a nuisance to us than a protection by preventing the spread of bioweapons. Unfortunately, I'm afraid the same may be becoming true of the Chemical Weapons Convention, too. Rumsfeld, in congressional testimony on the 5th of February, actually called the Chemical Weapons Convention a straitjacket, because there are certain chemicals that they would like to use in Iraq if they go in.
Well, you've asked the question, and others have asked the question, does the U.S. reluctance to reveal these offensive programs, does it not encourage other nations to develop them? And I think back to a sort of a nuclear weapons analogy that in 1972, Nixon and Kissinger had the option as to whether to MIRV or not MIRV our missiles, multiply independent reentrant vehicles, which would, in essence, put 10 nuclear bombs on the top of each missile. Well, we had a technical advantage at that time, and they elected not to do so because thereby we had a temporary advantage. Well, the Soviets, of course, were behind us, but they caught up and then put 10 warheads on top of their missiles, leaving us, in the end, much less secure. Isn't there that same sort of possibility operating here?
Yeah, I think that's the critical issue here. The tendency for a country to develop a biological weapon is encouraged by two things. One is if it sees some actual utility to the weapon. And for many countries with aspirations to be regional powers, but without the capacity to develop a nuclear capability, these weapons might be attractive as a weapon that would allow them some regional dominance, as a weapon that would allow them to stand up to countries like the United States or Israel who are nuclear states. So there's a certain amount of attractiveness to them for that reason. The other reason that countries might be attracted to these kinds of weapons is if they can get away with it. And so the question is, how do we prevent that? How do we make it impossible to develop biological weapons clandestinely? And the only real answer is a substantial level of transparency, openness, and lack of secrecy and classification in the biodefense programs and in the pharmaceutical industries of all countries. And that has to include the United States. No country in the world is going to be open about its industry and about its biodefense if the United States keeps its own programs closely guarded. This is an area in which the United States has to lead. If anything's going to be done, it's got to be led by the United States. In the long run, I think there is no way to prevent the proliferation of biological or chemical weapons, probably true of nuclear weapons as well, unless we have a substantial level of transparency. And so I think the best thing the United States could do would be to eliminate almost all classification in the area of biodefense. I think it's certainly legitimate to classify certain results, but we should be absolutely open and forthcoming with what experiments we are doing and why we are doing them. And if we get results which we think would be dangerous if they were disseminated, then we can classify those particular results. But we should be completely open about what's going on in our weapons laboratories. And if we don't, there are a lot of other countries that will not believe our assertions that we're not making new biological weapons or not making new chemical weapons. They will believe that we're making these weapons. Since we're making these weapons, they will believe that they need to have programs like that.
Exactly as the case of the Soviet Union back in the 70s. Exactly. They figure we're cheating, so we might as well go ahead.
That's right. Exactly.
Well, Dr. Mark Wheelis, thanks very much for your most informative discussion on these issues.
Thank you. Sleep well.
That was Dr. Mark Wheelis, microbiologist and bioweapons expert here at UC Davis. Most informative talk. We have a few extra minutes of that talk that we will play a few weeks from now when we address the issue of these so-called non-lethal agents that were employed. There was a famous episode here at the Moscow Theater where a gas was pumped in, incapacitating people and unfortunately killing a number. So We'll round out this discussion, I think, with that little talk some weeks from now. On next week's show, we're going to look at current events and what's going on and as regards the impending war with Iraq. We will also take a look, as promised, at genetic engineering, specifically the book The Botany of Desire, with its most interesting chapters, particularly on two crops, marijuana, hemp, and the potato. We'll also take a few minutes next week to look at the history of the nation that we now know today as Iraq, but throughout history was known as Sumeria, as Babylonia, as Chaldea, as part of the Persian Empire, as part of the Parthian Empire, and a place where the lost tribes of Israel wound up. You've been listening to Radio Parallax on KDVS 90.3 FM. I'm Douglas Everett, and invite you to stay tuned for Todd Urich and his interesting musical program, Hometown Atrocities. We'll see you next Thursday at 5 p.m.